89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.
I'm Leo Metzger. You're listening to Metzger Interviews. Tom Snow is one of the world's most successful and recorded songwriters. Since the 1970s, he's served as the brain behind countless hit records, as well as those in film, television, and stage. And among many of his achievements are 15 BMI Awards, which are for songs that receive a million or more plays on radio. And it gives me great pleasure to have him on the line. Tom, thank you very much for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You gave a really great TED Talk a few years ago, and you conveyed the endorphin rush that you felt when you were writing He's So Shy for the Pointer Sisters. I'm curious to know, when you listen to your own compositions now, do you get an adrenaline kick like everyone else does?
Yeah, I think so. My first thought is, I can't believe I wrote that. Because like so many, I don't know about lyricists, but composers, we don't really know where it comes from. That's why we filled a psychiatrist's couch. And, you know, my good friend Barry Mann, who just lost his wife, Cynthia, was always that way. It's just, I don't know where it's coming from. And, you know, what a brilliant talent. But yeah, I love it if I'm walking by a grocery store or somewhere and randomly on comes one of my songs. It's a great feeling.
So Cynthia Weil wrote the lyrics to that, and I hear that it wasn't originally intended for the Pointer Sisters.
No, I was writing it for my good friend Leo Sayre, who is down your way.
Mm.
And we have a lot of affection for each other. And I remember his wife, as much as an extrovert Leo is, his wife was equally as shy. And Leo really gave me my break by agreeing to write with me. And that got me into the, for lack of a better term, the big league songwriting world. And so after weeks of nothing happening, suddenly this melody appeared. And I had the title in my head, She's So Shy, because I was thinking of his then wife, Jan, who was terribly, terribly shy. So I pitched it to Leo, and Adam Faith and his management passed on it, which is fine, I understand. And then I took it to Richard Perry, for whom I was actually signed to a co-publishing deal. And he said, this would be great for the Pointers. We'd do it sort of like a 50s, 60s girl group thing and call it He's So Shy. So that's how that came about.
Eastside Radio.
When I hear that song, that gender reversal from Leo Sayre to the Pointer Sisters works seamlessly because it's the song has a very feminine quality to it. Some people even call it girl group pop. Are there certain musical elements that determine the gender of a song?
Well, I don't know. I suppose you could say because I had in mind Leo's wife, that was where the melody came from. And the title certainly gave the point of view. Titles are so crucial to writing good pop songs. If you have that in mind, which I did, maybe I wrote a sort of a feminine melody. I don't know the difference between one or the other. I guess Thunder in My Heart was the more masculine thing that I wrote with Leo, but who knows?
Yeah, I was just thinking about it because it came to me that feminine sounding songs, there's more of an emphasis on almost the snare drum and the claps, whereas masculine songs have emphasis on the kick drum. That's a major generalization, but I was just thinking that for a moment, and I wondered perhaps that could be intentional, but maybe not.
I really don't know, because I wrote the melody to those old Roland rhythm boxes that they would have in bars that just go click, click, tick, 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 tick. You know, There was no kick drum. It was actually, that particular melody came as a result of playing G minor arpeggio because I couldn't make music. I mean, I'd couple of weeks of hours and hours sitting at piano and nothing coming up. And I said, well, let's just go back to rudiments. And once I started playing that arpeggio, my higher power or whatever you want to call it came into play and up popped He's So Shy. And I knew it was a hit, even though it didn't have a lyric, which my dear and departed friend Cynthia flushed out. But I said, oh, okay. This one's a million seller.
89.7 FM.
Well, speaking of piano, in 1965, you entered the Berklee College of Music in the hopes of becoming a jazz pianist, but then you felt that your path was more in songwriting, and you graduated with a degree in music composition, And then you moved to California in 1969 to begin a songwriting career. What genres of music were you into at that point in time?
Well, 65 to 69 was a pretty rich year of rock and roll, pop, folk. I mean, there was a lot of great songwriting going on from Beatles, Stones, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison. All of it was very rich. At the same time, I was in a school for jazz. So I was learning a lot of jazz theory and compositional harmony. So when I got out to LA, all I wanted was a way to find myself into the music community. I was never going to be a jazz pianist. I had a fantasy of that, but I was nowhere good enough to play on the level of a Bill Evans or a Red Garland or any of those guys. But because I kind of came up, I was involved with Graham Parsons, who was at Harvard, and I played clubs in Boston. So I guess despite the fact that I had this jazz education, I was really into, I think everybody was, one of the golden ages of songwriting, which was 65 to early 70s. So I was influenced, and that seemed the way for me to carry on my career because I wasn't going to be a jazz pianist playing anywhere significantly.
Is that good advice, do you think, for people entering the music industry, is once you work out where your strengths are, just really stick to them?
Exactly. I mean, if one door doesn't open for you, don't keep pounding against it. Maximize your strengths. Minimize your weaknesses, which is, I think, good advice for anybody in any field of endeavor. But in particular in music, I mean, if you're not going to be the next Bill Evans or Chick Corea, find out what you're good at and go after it.
89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.
In 1975, you released a solo album called Taking It All in Stride. That was on Capitol Records. The first track on that was called You, which 2 years later was covered here in Australia by Marsha Hines, and it peaked at number 2 on our charts. What are your memories of writing that song?
Well, I wasn't writing it for anybody but myself. I think I was just writing it because I had this record deal. And the record didn't go very far. I remember I had a fan club up in Missoula, Montana. Very astute bunch of people. But actually, it was first covered by Rita Coolidge, if I'm not incorrect. And it was produced by Booker T. And it made enough noise in America that I got a BMI, my first ever performance award. That sort of kicked me up a notch, and I was able to start writing with people like Cynthia and onwards. And Marsha Hines. I mean, I didn't know Marsha Hines. It came to me as a surprise that it was such a big hit, but I always liked that song. Finally, I accepted the fact that, hey, you're not an artist. You're a behind-the-line songwriter. And when I heard Marsha's, that was knocked out, bowled over. It was a wonderful feeling.
Are you informed when someone covers a song of yours, or do songwriters sort of just stumble upon them at some point in time?
Well, mostly you find out because they have to get a license. At that point, because that song was recorded for an album that I did for Capitol, they weren't too interested in letting me know. Ever since then, I've been my own publisher. Now, I have independent publishing deals, a couple around the world. I'm getting pretty old here, Leo. I'm 75.
That's fantastic. Well, I'll tell you, the song You, Marsha Hines, it's on radio in Australia all the time. It's a huge hit here.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Great to hear.
89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.
In 1977, as you mentioned, you worked with Leo Sayer. You described that as a big break for you. It was Thunder in My Heart. And you co-wrote many of the songs, including the title track of that album. And a lot of the personnel were very high-profile people like David Paich, Jeff Beccaro, Steve Lukather. Even Gene Page, he did the string arrangements. People would know him as Barry White's arranger.
Yeah.
As a composer, in the late 70s, what was the transition into writing disco music like for you?
Well, I never really wrote disco. I think some of my songs were interpreted that way. I know that in the case of Thunder in My Heart, with Richard Perry producing, Leo and I wrote a song that we thought would be great. And I can't even remember the title of the song. Well, we took it to Richard and he said, you know, this needs a little more passion. Then he started going, you know, sort of giving us the essence of what would eventually become Thunder. And I never thought of that as a disco song. Neither did I think of You by Rita. So I think it was more the producer and the artist and the record company deciding that this would make a good disco-y song. I never thought of disco as a genre to write for.
That's interesting. So producers turned songs into disco almost at that point in time. You were giving the template and then they allocated a genre to it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, your very own Barry Gibb, he's so brilliant. I think they did that intentionally. But I just sat down and pounded out stuff on the piano, ballads. I liked R&B and I liked grooves, but I wasn't a big fan of the boom, 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 boom thing. So I never really wrote to that.
Eastside Radio.
I remember in your TED Talk, you were also saying how, as a songwriter, it's a very competitive industry and you do go through periods of doubt and writer's block. You said that it's often once you forget about the external pressures around you that the creativity starts to flow. I was thinking, could one say that sometimes being unaware of your competition is conducive to creativity?
Oh, absolutely. Because then you're just being yourself. You're not trying to be or beat somebody else. You know that from the great singer-songwriters of my era, like James Taylor or Jackson Brown. And I mean, they weren't competing with anybody. They were writing their story. My thing was a little different in that I was part of a group of associates, colleagues, whatever you want to call them, writing for another artist. Like the word would go out that Linda Ronstadt was looking for material for out. Everybody get on there, Linda Ronstadt had. That's sort of part of being a tunesmith. I mean, it is a craft. For some people, it's just their life story, and that happens to be relevant and commercial. Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil were a great example of people who didn't write for themselves. They wrote these great songs. Carole King, Jerry Goffin, that whole gang. I mean, they were an inspiration to me once I realized that nobody was terribly interested in my personal story as an artist. And I really enjoyed much more learning to craft a song and still be musically true to myself and not write down. I never wrote down. I always just wrote, but I wasn't trying to tell my life story. Basically, I went back to writing melodies, which I have a degree in composition from Berkeley. And when I hear a song, the first thing I hear is music. I don't hear the lyrics. I don't care who wrote it.
Yeah, I think I even heard Barry Gibb say that the Bee Gees were first and foremost devoted to the music and the lyrics were secondary as well.
Yeah. Well, I don't think anybody would ever call the Bee Gees Bob Dylan or Lorenz Hart or Cole Porter, but they had this fabulous sound. I like them just as much as I like the Beatles.
89.7 FM.
Speaking of crafting music for an artist, you were almost like a suit tailor, tailoring a song to an artist. In 1982, you had, quote, the single most important learning experience of your career, and it happened whilst co-writing Olivia Newton-John's song Make a Move on Me with John Farrar, who was an Australian producer. What was it that you learned?
Yeah. I learned how to work really hard at the craft, which John, a very humble and I consider a great friend and a brilliant guy, a very soft-spoken guy, but he would not accept anything from himself that wasn't the very best. And I had musical talent and I would throw these songs off, but it wasn't until I got together with John that I understood what a craft songwriting was, or as you say, making a suit for someone, tailoring. John taught me, without ever saying anything, more than I've ever learned from anybody. So I credit John with a lot of what I've done just because of the way he approached writing for Olivia, and incredibly musically talented, but not egotistically. He wrote for Olivia. He crafted songs. it was an eye-opening experience. Make a Move on Me was just great because some of the song is my jazz training, like the intro. It was just a great collaboration. We wrote up a nice bunch of songs together.
You can also hear you on the synthesizer doing the bass note repetition. Did I hear that John needed you to time that perfectly because there was no programmed synthesizer in those days?
Exactly. Especially the bass line. I had to do it until it was right on, and we kept taping it. And finally, when we got the right tape, David Holman, who was the engineer, and this was all done in a garage, he cut that and then spliced it. And then we had the perfectly timed, which you can do now in 2 seconds with Pro Tools or whatever. But I actually had to bear down and get my timing right and play that thing perfectly. And then when John said, okay, that's it, it was a relief. It took a few, it took a while.
That'd be like a mind game.
Yeah, exactly. John was always very encouraging and very patient. And he said, that's okay, mate. You almost got it. You almost.
Yeah.
Eastside Radio.
I ask people often who lived through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I ask them, what was it like? Did you notice the change in styles in those decades? Because the aesthetic of those decades, just in fashion, is so distinct. But I'm wondering with synthesizer, it almost seems to me once the 80s came around, synthesizer was instantly added into the sound. Did you feel that at all?
Yeah, I did. And even more than that, the drum machine freed up any songwriter who didn't have a band or a place to rehearse a song. And I remember John Farrock called me up and he said, mate, you got to get this Linn drum machine. It's amazing. It had the sounds of drums and you could tweak a few buttons and all of a sudden you were playing to a drummer, which was always better than playing to a metronome. You had a little feel, you could make your own groove. So I would say the drum machine for me was more enlightening than the synthesizer.
Yeah.
I wasn't very good at tweaking all the little things to make noises. My favorite was the Prophet 5 because it had a thick, groovy sound. But I was not into patching and chords and tweaking sine wave and all that. That didn't do a thing for me. But the drum machine really, really helped.
89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.
You've also said that the difference between the talented amateur and the seasoned professional songwriter is the ability and willingness to rewrite. And that was exemplified in 1984 when you wrote arguably your biggest song for the film Footloose. Could you tell us about that scenario?
Oh, yeah. Dean Pitchford, who wrote the screenplay and all the lyrics, there were some songs pre-photography that needed to be written because the choreographer wanted to choreograph to a certain beat and a certain feel. And so Dean and I wrote a song that doesn't feature very large in the film, but it did in the Broadway production, but it's called Somebody's Eyes. And it was used by Lynn Taylor Corbett for a number of scenes to choreograph. She used that song. And she used it because she was listening mostly to the rhythm of the dump, bump, bump, bump. I think it was 120 beats per minute to choreograph the scene where Ren is teaching Willard to dance. So the movie got shot and they got down to editing and they started looking at scenes with the accompanying music. And the director, Herb Ross, said, you know, I don't think this Somebody's Eyes is actually working with this celebratory dance moment where Ren teaches Willard to dance. So I said, okay, fine. Well, just send me the video with the click track. The click track is the metronome to the film. So you're listening to click, 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 click. So that's your tempo. They sent me the video and I sat down with my Prophet 5 synthesizer and eventually came up with the bass line, da, 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 to totally make it more of a happy celebratory event rather than the suspicious feel of Somebody's Eyes, which was written for a totally different dramatic moment. So that was huge. And it didn't take long. And then Dean, he lived just a few streets down from me, came over to the house, and we fleshed out the song together. And there it was. Let's hear it for the boy.
And I hear that there was a great moment when Denise Williams heard it for the first time.
Yes. We went over to Dean's house, and Greg Zayden, the producer, and other people involved with the movie were there. And Dean had a piano, and I had sort of written out a lead sheet, which is just the melody and the chords. And Denise came and sat on the bench next to me. I was playing the bass line and singing it to her, and Dean was singing along with me. And we were selling the song, Leo, I tell you. And she bought it, man. She wrote in the upper right corner of the lead sheet, number one.
Oh, that's fantastic. It just makes you happy, that song. It really does.
I know. It's a joyful tune.
89.7 FM.
Your music is very positive in its sound. And it seems since the turn of the 21st century, various genres within popular music are slightly more raw and often a bit darker thematically. Larry Gold of Philadelphia said that the Philly sound of the 90s was a lot more raw and gritty than the sound of the 70s, whether it be musically or lyrically. I'm wondering if you have any theories on why that may be the case.
I listen to a lot of, I don't write anymore, but I think there's some wonderful songwriters out there. I don't listen to top 40 because I call that music noise, but I don't know. There was definitely a change in the zeitgeist culturally that brought about this introspective. I mean, there were always introspective songs, but commercially speaking, I mean, from the 50s post-war all the way through the 80s until hip-hop, something happened and people started writing songs about how sorry they felt for themselves. So I always believed that uplifting music was the greatest and the hardest music to write. It's easy to write sad. It's hard to write happy and not sound corny.
Ah, okay. That's interesting. Are major chords harder to make it sound sophisticated?
Yeah, absolutely. In natural, they have a thing. It's three chords and the truth.
Yeah. I mean, songwriters of your era, you were creating songs to use as energy to uplift the mood and so people would forget the negative. But maybe today songwriters are wanting to recreate the emotions that are concerning them using music. The music's almost compartmentalizing their emotions.
I totally agree. I think also, for the most part, the songwriter from my era, much more sophisticated musically than the sort of folky, you know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to denigrate, but the music from Philadelphia, Tom Bell and those guys, the music out of Motown, you know, Nashville always has been three chords of the truth. And that's fine because that's the whole thing. I mean, Nashville is a lyric driven town, not a music driven town. But until hip hop came along, you had to have something tricky, something musically hooky. And it wasn't always one major, four major, five major, one major. 1-4-5, as we say in music school. So it's a different time. Having said that, I'm a big Spotify guy. I love that. I'm always discovering some interesting songs there.
Mm.
But I'm more a fan of Snarky Puppy than I am of... I guess I'm falling back on my jazz roots. Duke Ellington said there's two kinds of music. There's the kind you like and there's the kind you don't like.
Yeah, it seems as musicians get into later stages of life, they revert back to the roots that they started with.
Exactly. Well said.
Tom, I really appreciate your time. It's been a really great pleasure chatting with you.
I'm really touched that you know who I am and like what I did and play it. That means a lot to me. It's been a pleasure.
89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.